Hello, this is Science Weekly, and I'm not Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, we have the man often known as the rockstar physicist. Sorry about that, Brian. Brian Cox tells us about his wonders of the solar system.
If you want to talk about the processes that led to these volcanoes on this tiny moon of Jupiter, then where better to do it than the Eritrean border?
After the world's top scientists gathered in San Diego, what came out of the AAAS?
There were some really good stories there. Okay, the sunshine helped. And for the first time in my experience, we had a window in the press office, which really helped to get some natural daylight in.
Plus, one of Britain's most prominent scientists, with one of the most distinctive voices and the most recognisable facial hair.
Ethics is not taught to science students except in medicine, virtually at all, routinely. And I think it should be. And I think it's one example of what I'm kind of pleading for.
And we speak to the president of the Flat Earth Society. So how does he explain those images taken from space?
Anything like that could have been easily faked. I mean, especially with the technology we have today, you can simulate alien worlds, ghosts, demons, you know, massive battles of orcs and anything else you want. I don't think that proves much of anything.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, I'm Nell Bowes, standing in for Alok. In the studio with me today is The Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample, just back from the AAAS in San Diego, Ian.
That's right, yeah, hi Nell.
Nice and sunny there?
Yeah, beautiful, stunning, gutted to be back.
And also David Adam, our environment correspondent.
Hello.
Our guest is Brian Cox. Now, I've just watched the promo for your latest series, so you must be back from somewhere exotic.
Yeah, it was hard work, actually. I won't get anyone to believe this, but we filmed in some of the most difficult places in the world. On the Eritrean border, for example, which is a really difficult place to go and film. And actually, you can imagine the health and safety document that they fill in, because you get flown into this active volcano by the Ethiopian Air Force a war zone, essentially. It's almost a war zone on that border. And so there's this 100-page health and safety document that the BBC have you fill in. And in the end, the people said to us, well, the biggest threat to your health and safety was the BBC's health and safety document, because everybody in Africa knew that you were there. And so we camped with all these armed guards for about 4 days filming an active volcano.
Beautiful target right here.
Which exploded while we were there, by the way. And our guy who went down on his rope to look at it said, I was misinformed. Nobody told me it was fucking active. But that's why we were there to film it. So yeah, we had some adventures.
Did you get it out?
So this is fantastic. So tell us, why were you in Eritrea?
Well, the idea of the series was not to make another series with loads of CGI about the solar system, although there is the beautiful effects in there.
But so Brian's just to fill everyone in, he's doing a series called The Seven Wonders of the Solar System, which starts next Sunday.
Yes. So it's a five-part series, one of these big BBC series, but we didn't want to just have pretty pictures of planets there. We wanted to go to places on Earth that you could stand in front of and explain some geological processes or something about the planets and moons of the solar system. So on the Ethiopian-Eritrean border, there's a volcano called Erta Ale, which is a lava lake, and it's one of the only, I think there are three on the planet. And this is the most accessible one, right in the middle of this barren wasteland.
In a war zone.
Well, essentially, yeah. And so it's like these lakes of lava are also present on Jupiter's moon Io, which is the most volcanic moon in the solar system. So if you want to talk about the processes that led to these volcanoes on this tiny moon of Jupiter, then where better to do it than the Eritrean border?
I'm interested. Do you think science programming is getting better? I mean, there's quite a lot of these almost travel-based programs that enjoy the Earth and use that as a springboard, and Marcus's series on maths and things like that. Are things getting better, or is it all downhill since Sagan's Cosmos?
Well, there's two things there, because I do think Sagan's Cosmos is a work of genius and probably the greatest documentary ever made. So therefore, it probably is downhill by that. But what I think is good, the BBC are doing a lot more of these things, and Ian Stewart's programmes as well, for example, Alice Roberts's programmes. So there are these big glossy series which you need, because I think we often forget, people of my generation who saw Cosmos. One of the reasons it was brilliant was because that's the first time we saw that stuff. So a lot of, there's even 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds who weren't born when Cosmos was on and have never seen it. So I think we do have to remember that you need to put the epic back on the screen again, relatively regularly. Otherwise, you just lose a whole generation of people. And actually, I think also the BBC understand that there's now a range of audiences you can access. So you know, there's also Jim Al-Khalili's documentaries, for example, on BBC Four. So you've got the real science geek stuff. And then what I'm doing on BBC Two is kind of half and half. I think there's a realization that it's great to get as big an audience and as wide a demographic as possible, but I'm very keen on not, you know, the usual dumbing down. And I know it's a cliche that, but there's obviously a temptation to do that. So I think the balance is right.
I saw you on YouTube trying to explain to your producer about gravity waves. It looked like quite a painful process.
That was Horizon, actually. So that was one of the clever producers.
Ian, you had a question.
Yeah, well, just a point first. I mean, I bought Carl Sagan's Cosmos fairly recently, actually, because I hadn't seen it before, and they came out with some sort of remastered version just to sort of flog it off again. And it's kind of endearing, but it's, I think for the first time in my life, to defend modern science documentaries, the stuff that is being put out now by some of the networks is so much more engaging, actually. I mean, I think Cosmos is brilliant and it's incredibly authoritative, but in terms of having real people involved, and certainly I think the sort of the how compelling they are, I think what goes out today is actually scores a lot of points.
Yeah, I mean, Cosmos, you remember, it's 13 hours.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's just...
I tried to watch the whole lot in one sitting.
Yeah. I've never seen it. I was going to ask you to borrow it, but I'm not now.
No, it's absolutely brilliant. It's brilliant, actually, is that it's not only a science documentary, there's an agenda there. I mean, the 13th episode, which is quite famous, is just a rant about the idiocy of nuclear war, right? It's not a science documentary at all, but it is. It's from a scientist's perspective. It's a comment on the way civilization was in the late 70s, and I think that's important, actually. And there's some minor element of polemic, actually.
I was going to say, have you got an agenda?
There is, I do have an agenda, which is I think that as a society we do not value science as anything like the level that we should. I think our government funding of science is too low. It's below average in the UK, actually, below the European average, below the OECD average. So I do have an agenda, which is to, first of all, to present the most remarkable things that we've discovered over the last 10 or 20 years, because they were paid for by taxpayers' money, and so people should see what's been discovered. But also, really, I think to make a case for the fact that exploration is not a luxury. I think it's seen as that, especially at the moment. You know, scientific exploration of the universe for the sake of curiosity-driven science appears to be a luxury, and I contend it isn't. It's a necessity.
Oh, well, we'll go on to talk a bit more about funding and recent changes later in the programme. I had one last question. I wanted to know, you're based at Manchester and CERN at the moment, when you're not proselytising in insanely beautiful and slightly dangerous places. How are things going with the LHC?
Very well. It's about to turn on for what we call physics runs, so actually collisions with the aim of doing science rather than just testing the machine, about now, actually, or in the next couple of weeks. And it's going to run for 18 months to 2 years at half power, so which is still far in excess of anything we've done before. But it's a safe way of running that we understand for the machine. Not, I mean, safe in an engineering sense, by the way, not the nutter. So
it's not blowing up the known universe.
Blow the world
around.
It's the way that we can understand the machine and get physics out, understand the operation of the machine.
And
so
how
that's
quickly
exciting.
Are you expecting to be kind of processing results?
Oh, I mean, there are papers already on the results we took before Christmas, which were just a few, you know, hundreds of thousands of collisions, let's say. But now we're going to run in a mode where we're going to do real physics for about the next 18 months, 2 years, then take the machine up to full power and then carry on.
What are the chances of sort of CERN being able to look at what you might call sort of new physics beyond what the sort of US competitor, if you like, Tevatron at Fermilab is already doing? Because obviously they've been running for a good long time. They have an awful lot of collisions. And I think it'll take a while for the LHC to sort of come up to where they're at the moment, but you'll be at higher energy from kickoff in the next few weeks. I mean, what are the chances of you seeing stuff that they haven't been able to see?
In the next 6 months or so, I would say that we're catching up, because, as you say, although the Tevatron runs at lower energy, it has the advantage of the detectors are extremely well understood, and there's a lot of collisions there for them to look at. So I think by the end of the 18-month run, then we should be at or beyond that level, I would say. Unless there's something just on the edge of their energy reach that the LHC just stumbles into. I mean, there's always that possibility. But if I were to put my money on it, I would say that we're in a phase of first calibrating the detectors, understanding them, and gathering the data at this energy, which is about, I mean, it is about, what, three times the energy of the Tevatron, even now.
Can you talk us through a bit more, I don't know how possible it is, exactly what you're interested in, as opposed to kind of, we've got a general kind of Higgs boson, dark matter sort of ideas, but what are you looking at?
Well, there's two things. I mean, one is I ran a little upgrade project, which is aimed at putting little detectors but half a kilometre away from the place where the collisions happen. So you can imagine these two protons come and collide together, and we have these big detectors like ATLAS and CMS surrounding the collision points. But you can get these processes where the protons, rather than smash into each other and cause a big collision, just glance off each other, actually stay intact but lose a bit of energy. And it's called diffraction, and it's been known for many decades. But it's a process where you could produce new particles, like, for example, Higgs particles. But it requires these little detectors, and they go about, let's say, 5 millimeters away from the proton beams, half a kilometer away from the collision point. And remember, these beams have the kinetic energy of an aircraft carrier traveling at 30 miles an hour. And you get these little detectors into 5 millimeters. I mean, look at a ruler, 5 millimeters in there. It's a great challenge, but it's a great way of doing really high precision measurements of things like Higgs particles. Should they exist? I mean, I should say that.
Where we sometimes ask people to take a bet. Where do you stand?
I don't know. My most cited paper is something called WW scattering in the absence of a light Higgs particle. So I actually wrote a paper saying how you would go about searching for the origin of mass in the universe in general without assuming anything. Because we know where to look without any assumptions for that process, the process that gives mass to things in the universe. The Higgs is a theory on top of that that says, well, it could be this. But just from an experimentalist perspective, the most honest thing to do, in a way, the most precise thing to do, just go and look exactly where you know something is going to happen, and we can do that.
Brian Cox and his Wonders of the Solar System begins on Sunday on BBC Two, and of course is available on iPlayer after that. And now for something completely bonkers.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
From cutting-edge physics to science from the dark ages, the Flat Earth Society has a new president. Daniel Shenton genuinely believes that we are all living on a frisbee floating in space. David Adam met him. David, what planet is he on?
Well, it does sound a bit bonkers. Well, it is bonkers. I should say right at the beginning, not for a second do I think this guy has a point in any way. I mean, clearly he's wrong. The Earth is not flat. The Earth is round. And in fact, in the Dark Ages, we thought the Earth was round. A lot of the stuff about Columbus and his sailors supposedly mutinied because they thought they would fall off the Earth, just not true. It dates back to about the 3rd century BC that most people who thought about this actually realised the Earth was round.
So why are we interested in it?
Well, the Flat Earth Society has reconvened. It's reformed. It's recruiting members. I found out about it, and I assumed it must be a hoax, or it must be a PR stunt for another cause, or maybe just people out to cause trouble. So I just went along and met him, and people can judge for themselves, because we've got a clip.
And here's David talking to Daniel Shenton.
I see the world as being flat. It's a disc. I mean, there are changes in the surface, but generally it's a flat disc.
And what about the other, the planets, the sun, the moon?
I'm not sure about them. It seems to me from the evidence that I've seen that they're probably spheres, but it's definitely not proven, I think.
And the Earth, being a disk, presents certain problems with gravity, but you have a solution to that too?
Yeah, the effects of gravity, I feel, could be simulated, or what people think of as a sort of mainstream idea of gravity would be simulated by simply the disk of the Earth moving upward, accelerating upward at 9.8 meters per second. It would have the same effects as what people traditionally think of as gravity.
And what about all of the photographs? I mean, the Flat Earth Society seemed to die in the sort of the space age, when people got out of Earth's orbit and sent back pretty damning evidence that actually the Earth is a sphere.
As far as the evidence of the space age, I would say that anything
like that could have been easily faked. I mean, especially with the technology we have today, you can simulate alien worlds, ghosts, demons, you know, massive battles of orcs and anything else you want. It's, I don't think that proves much of anything.
But why would people do it? Why would people go to the effort of this giant, I presume you think it's a giant global conspiracy to cover up the fact the Earth is flat? Why would they do that?
There probably are financial motives behind it. And I don't think this, the conspiracy needs to be as, well, global as you would think. If you get pockets of conspiracy, most people aren't going to look into it very much. They're not going to investigate it, and they'll just accept these things at face value that the Earth is a sphere. Not everyone needs to actually be part of it for this to propagate pretty quickly.
Now, a lot of our listeners might think this is just genuine nuts, sort of anti-science babble, but actually there's a serious scientific strand to this, isn't there? Because you think it's all about not trusting what you see and testing.
Yeah, if you, before the Flat Earth Society was the Flat Earth Society, it was called the Universal Zetetic Society in the 1800s. It was a group of people that wouldn't accept mainstream science because they didn't feel that all these things had necessarily been proved. Their idea was that they needed to go out and investigate these things for themselves and get really solid evidence. And about a lot of issues, like the shape of the Earth, people don't do that. They just accept what most people believe as fact, even though they haven't looked into it themselves. And I think it's really important that people get out and, you know, investigate these things and prove it to themselves instead of just accepting it because it's the mainstream view.
And the old chestnut, if the Earth's flat, what stops people falling off?
Nothing, I suppose. There's a barrier around the edge, but ultimately I think if you could get past that, you would fall off.
And you're serious about this, aren't you? This isn't a clever metaphor or a marketing ploy for something else. This is what you truly believe.
It is. If it's a marketing ploy for something, then I'm not aware of it, and I'm certainly not getting paid for it. So,
so interesting, the upwardly accelerating disc.
That's correct.
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's,
that
get
is
the same
correct.
Effect.
It's called the equivalence principle.
But how do you feel, Brian, about this idea of everyone checking everything out for themselves?
That's correct as well, actually. I mean, it's. I suppose the problem is that, and this is a debate that's often had in the media, while science is about not accepting any statements from authority, right? So science at its heart is about checking everything for yourself and being appropriately sceptical. You have to at some point accept the settled view of experts because there's too much science. So you can't be an expert in, you know, childhood vaccinations and the shape of the Earth and GPS positioning systems and everything else. You know, you can't be, no one can be an expert on everything. So the my view is that the point of science and that the peer review structure and the way that science is built is to allow people, including other scientists and the public, to have confidence in this settled view that is arrived at. For example, on global warming, it's a difficult subject. It's, if you want to go through the literature and understand the computer simulations of what it means to put this amount of CO2 into the atmosphere, then it's a full-time job, right? So at some point, you've got to say, well, I respect the peer review process, and that can be my sceptical voice for all these myriad issues that I don't simply have the time to become an expert on.
You need a sort of chain of confidence because you don't necessarily have the BBC funding to nip up in a plane and look at whether it's round or not.
Well, there was that. I did in Wonders of the Solar System, I did fly up in a plane and to 60,000 feet. So anyone who's been in Concorde has been that high and you see the curvature of the Earth.
So if we three believe you, then that's a start.
In that case. But I do like it. I'm tempted to join the Flat Earth Society because I do take your point, David, that it's as an idea, be a sceptic. I like the idea of the Flat Earth Society. In this case, it's probably picked the wrong thing to be sceptical about.
I think it raises to me a couple of issues that are worth discussion. And I think that one of them is that if you cannot convince people in the 21st century that the Earth is round, then there are some people you will not convince about any scientific issues. And at which point do we say we just have to move on and accept that some people are always going to think that global warming is a hoax, for example? And we cannot convince everyone, and we cannot engage with these people all the time because they quite readily admit, you know, nothing will ever convince me. Whatever you say, I just, and psychologists call it a self-sealing problem, that there's this idea of a conspiracy and all of the extra evidence that you add to show them that they're wrong actually adds to the conspiracy.
It's a very good point, actually, about engaging with these kind of denialists, because CERN, we've had some trouble, and we're still having trouble with these kind of black hole will destroy the world people. And what CERN's response, which I think in hindsight might have been wrong or is certainly questionable, is was to say, right, we're going to demolish these idiots. We will produce a series of papers that just spells out exactly why we know that the world is not going to be destroyed by bumping a few protons together. But what that did and has done is legitimise, as you say, this kind of denialist conspiracy theory movement. And you're right about these people. They're irrational by definition, and therefore nothing you can do in argument terms will convince them otherwise. There's a conspiracy everywhere. And so what you end up doing, and I think we've done it to an extent, is legitimise them. The thing is that the CERN thing is not that important, I think, because they're not going to... There's no injunction to stop the LHC. It's all nonsense, and the world is not going to be destroyed. It doesn't matter. It'll go away. But I think, as you said, there are issues like MMR, like childhood vaccinations, like AIDS, like climate change, where it does actually matter. And the same techniques and the same idiots, actually usually the very same idiots, are actually sowing the seeds of doubt in the public mind. And because science is so complex, I like the idea of having some safe ground to debate the arguments, actually, with the flat Earth, rather than debate it, as you say. If you debate it in an MMR scenario, then you do immense damage. You kill kids, basically.
Because that's just the illusion of debate, which is enough to convince people that there is a debate. An issue there.
We're interested to get your thoughts on this, so leave your scribblings on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Make sure you subscribe while you're there so every podcast gets automatically delivered to your MP3 device. Takes all the hard work out of listening.
Science Weekly.
Some of the world's leading scientists have been gathering in San Diego. No, not for the beaches and the California sunshine. It's for the AAAS. For those who don't know, that stands for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Ian, you were there, locked away, writing feverishly. I've counted scores of stories. How was it? What was the most interesting that came out during the week?
It was really good fun, actually. And I try, when I go away on these things and you go somewhere nice, you sort of try and say, oh, yeah, well, it was really hard work. A bit like Brian, really. I mean, he was just watching his video. He's flying around in jets at 60,000 feet, standing around in exotic places, and comes in and says, oh, it was really hard work, actually. I'm sure it was.
Some of it wasn't, but some of it was.
But I'm sure it was a lot of fun
as
well.
San Diego is different to Eritrea, yeah. I'm telling you.
No, it was good. And what made it good was there were some really good stories there. Okay, the sunshine helped. And for the first time in my experience, we had a window in the press office, which really helped to get some natural daylight in. But the most interesting story is quite hard to pick, actually. I mean, there were some which were really interesting conceptually. There were some which make you think, you know, this is important. It's the usual idea of, you know, what makes a good news story. I mean, this won't be the most exciting to a lot of people, but the one that I thought was actually really needed saying, because I don't know really if the voices over here have been saying it loudly enough, was that two really senior guys, scientists in the US, the head of the National Academy of Sciences, who's a guy called Ralph Cicerone, and the president of the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Peter Agre, who's a Nobel Prize winner, both came out talking about what Britain is likely to do to itself by funding cuts. And we're facing, you know, universities and research are facing $600 million in cuts. And after the election, it seems pretty clear that whichever party gets in will be making further cuts. And one of them said, look, Britain is more than likely going to see a gradual brain drain to places like US and Singapore, where they're still investing. And another one of them said that by doing this kind of thing, you damage science for a generation, because people leave it, they go and get other jobs, and they don't come back when the funding goes up in 5-10 years' time, because they're in other jobs. So you do harm things for the long term, and I think that was just really important.
Brian, how do you sort of see this as a problem? Are you even seeing effects of it now or later?
Yeah, we've got cuts at in astronomy and particle physics and those areas, nuclear physics particularly. We've got cuts probably on the 40% level already, which came from a mistake in 2007. The thing is that you can the budget is so tiny. Right, I mean, the entire research budget, the Research Council's budget, which is medical research, space research, everything, is about just over 3 billion, between 3 and 3.5 billion a year. That's everything, right? And so if you make a 50 million cut on that, that what happens is that postdocs don't get funded, which are the young people that you mentioned are going to come through and build our science base for the future. And I don't understand why, given the amounts of money are so tiny, we play this game of Russian roulette with the economy, because that's what it is. I mean, there's a really interesting figure from the Institute of Physics, which is that 6.4% of UK GDP comes from physics-based industry. 6.4. That's similar to the financial services, which is about 8.5, I think, or 9. Probably 6 now.
But what
you're doing by making cuts of these very small cuts in the higher education budget as a whole and the science budget, you're doing an experiment, right? You're saying, can Britain continue to function at the cutting edge of this kind of innovation economy, the innovation society, without spending the money in the foundations? And
your hunch is that it won't?
Well, yeah, it's. I think it's a very dangerous experiment and very odd, and I have no understanding of why the UK government is doing that.
Ian, there were some slightly light-hearted stories from the AAAS, I think. There's something about making Hollywood obey the laws of science?
Yeah, that's right. There's a group of scientists had set up this body which basically acts as consultants for sci-fi movies in Hollywood. And one of the guys from that outfit was speaking at the conference, and he had drawn up a couple of ground rules. The one I was particularly interested in was that a producer or a director is allowed one gross violation of the laws of physics. But from then on, basically, the story should pan out in a very sort of sensible way from that kind of consequence. And this has all manner of sort of implications for superheroes and other things. And he was saying, well, look.
So the Fantastic Four is buggers. So they need four violations.
Fantastic Four I think probably for each character, you may be able to have one at a push. But I mean, he was saying, look, it's fine in I have to say, this guideline doesn't hold up whatsoever, but it's a fun story nonetheless. He was saying, look, in Star Wars is an amazing movie, and you allow the fact that you can travel faster than the speed of light, because otherwise you'd be like a million years in between each scene. So, you know, it would make it even longer than it is already. But then, you know, he was pretty entertaining on his worst offenders, which
it was Avatar in there.
No, Avatar. No, it wasn't.
The thing about Avatar was the guided missiles in which still worked when they were on flying dragons.
I'm not familiar with Avatar.
It is. It's very curious logic, isn't it? Because you think, well, does it make a film more realistic if a guy is only allowed to fly rather than fly and shoot thunderbolts out of his fingers?
Well, what particularly got him was an excellent movie called The Core, which I'm sure it sounds like you know. And he was saying, look, first of all, they talk about so this is where the molten core of the Earth stops rotating. That doesn't affect the Earth's magnetic field, which obviously protects us from cosmic rays and such like. It, in the film, it affects the Earth's electromagnetic field, which he says doesn't exist. And even if you shut this thing down, in the film, it causes loads of lightning storms. He says he's no idea why that would be the case. And then obviously when they drill, they go on their mission to the core I think it was to plant some kind of nuclear device, obviously, to start the core going again. The sort of, you know, the classic linear story progression of, you know, increasing sort of hurdles they have to go over, just go from implausible to more implausible. And he was pulling his hair out about that one, saying, look, you lose any kind of public empathy or sympathy for your plot. And it actually bombed. I mean, it's not only if you annoy scientists, you annoy the public as well, because you're just taking the piss.
You know, everyone holds up 2001, don't they, as a great thing because they had this wonderful rotating set and everything. But I always think, you know, at the end of that, a little fetus came back into orbit. You know, I mean, that's, if you say it, it's ridiculous, right? But Kubrick gets away with it, doesn't he? Oh, and a fetus in orbit.
Brilliant. Well, that's his one violation, I suppose. Everything else was fine.
Oh, well, from the serious to the silly. We'll be hearing some of the interviews that Ian recorded at AAAS over the coming weeks, and you'll hear more of those stories later. Now, if you want to talk more about this, you can join our Facebook group. We've handily called ourselves the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. You can chat with other listeners and post comments on the wall. Now, he has arguably the best moustache in Britain. He is also one of our best-known scientists. It's Lord Robert Winston. He's written a book called Bad Ideas, An Arresting History of Our Inventions, which is about how our finest ideas sort of nearly finished us off. Professor Winston came into the Guardian studios and talked to the Observer's science and technology editor, Robin McKee, who asked him about how scientists are attempting to impose limits on society because of climate change.
I don't think you can impose limits on science because the very nature of Homo sapiens is that he is an inquisitive, she is an inquisitive species. And therefore, our wish to explore, to understand, to develop our ideas is absolutely innate in a way that it isn't anywhere else. So you can't control science. So to some extent, you actually have to control the effects of science. Yes. And clearly, if we really are to combat climate change, and if it is truly anthropocentric, which it seems, then a key thing is to have society on side. Without that, we failed. We have to, you know, the implications are we need to change behaviour. So there has to be a recognition that we do need to communicate much better with society. And also, at the same time, not necessarily trust governments that may have other agendas. So, for example, governments tend to have a short-term agenda. So it might be well within the interests of a particular government to say, well, we're not going to take much action with regard to climate change. We've seen this very clearly in Copenhagen, of course.
Yes.
We saw it at Kyoto as well, where governments, out of self-interest for the government, really, essentially, as much as for the nation which they represent, would take a strong view that this is something they're not going to do because it would put up taxation or change the economic value of what they're doing.
An advanced civilization first learns to develop technology but may never have the intelligence to control technology and will always wipe itself out.
I think I'm more optimistic than to believe that technology is going to wipe us out. In the history of mankind, we've continued to improve our lot using technology, and we've managed to control the worst aspects of it. I think climate change will be another example of whether we're able to do that. And there are all sorts of indications that that may be possible now. For example, the Royal Society has recently published its view on geoengineering, for example, how you might control that by carbon capture. I mean, a lot of it's pretty fanciful stuff, but nonetheless, those technologies are developing so quickly in many of our universities that it would be quite inexcusable not to take them seriously. I think one has to. And I think it's likely that somewhere we'll hit the button.
What about medical subjects?
Well, that's really interesting. Yeah. I've avoided that, haven't I? Yeah. Medical things. I mean, I've avoided that in this conversation. But I'm pretty hard on medicine in this book. I argue that medicine, which I wouldn't be without, has also been a force for less good. For example, if you look at our mishandling of the immune system using antibiotics in children, for example, and avoiding infection, we've certainly increased the risk of asthma. But it may well be that juvenile diabetes, for example, is much more common as a result of our failure to address the immune consequences. And there may be other diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, which are in that line as well. I don't think we really understand enough about autoimmune diseases, for example, which are very important. But it's possibly true that many of them are a product of the technological revolution in medicine, which is quite interesting. There are many other themes in medicine, but one of the things that worry me very much is that there's been increasingly, generally speaking, an impetus to diagnose, to make medicine a more scientific subject, actually forgetting the treatment, forgetting actually the patient. And I think there is a turnabout now in our medical schools where we're starting to address that issue. But certainly we have produced generations of doctors who either can't because of time constraints and bureaucracy or won't because of the way they've been taught actually communicate very well with their patients. And communication is a fantastic healer.
Would it be fair to say the theme of the book is sort of for every technological innovation, there's two steps forwards and then one back? Is that
yes.
sort of sum up your...
Well, I think, you know, we're seeing that with the genome. You know, the genome's a very good example, I think, of a technological innovation which was which in some ways was remarkable, was bruited as being an extraordinary achievement, but actually has achieved very little because, of course, we don't have anything like the power to implement what we might do with it. I mean, unless we have massive computing in the health service, for example, unless we completely rechange pathology services, retrain pathologists and change the laboratories, we're not going to be able to use the implications of the genome positively for patients, I think, at all. I think it's one of the big issues facing medicine. And I think, you know, on a broader scale, and I do attempt to try and deal with this a bit in the book, as medicine becomes more complex, it becomes more expensive, but we fail to have any kind of mature debate about how we're going to pay for it in the future. And that, I think, is a political issue which is very worrying. Can't really trust governments, can't trust politicians, and that's one of the messages actually in the book.
And there's a video of that interview at guardian.co.uk/video. Bad Ideas is out now. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, at Science Weekly, we'll let you know when a new podcast is launched. But to be alerted to all the Guardian Science content, follow at Guardian Science. My thanks to Ian Sample and David Adam, and especially to Brian Cox, whose new TV series, Wonders of the Solar System, begins this week on BBC Two. Don't forget to add your voice to the debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Next week, we'll have science writer Simon Singh in the studio talking about the UK's libel laws. We'll be discussing that old chestnut called freedom of speech. This podcast was produced by Andy Dockworth. I'm Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening.